hobbyists and atheists is reaching a fever pitch. Some seek to find common understanding and agreement. This is a place where we begin with differences and end with similarities. This is Apologia.
Hello, and welcome to Apologia. My name is Zachary Moore, and I'll be moderating and participating a bit in the discussion today. As always, Apologia is a group of theists and atheists who are here for a friendly roundtable discussion about our different perspectives and where we can find agreement. If you happen to have feedback for the discussion, you can give it at the website for this podcast, which is hosted at drzach.net. Today we have with us Kevin Harris, who is the Minister of Apologetics at the First Baptist Church of Colleyville and also the host of the Reasonable Faith podcast with Dr. William Lane Craig. We also have John Wilson, who is a student of philosophy and seminarian at now Dallas Theological Seminary. And we also will have joining us shortly Dan Sawyer, who is the author of Sculpting God and co-host of the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Gentlemen, welcome to the discussion.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, well, today we're going to just finish up our series on the Mythicist Hypothesis by turning over the attention to you guys, Kevin and John, who are the resident Christians here at this discussion. The series up to this point has been focused on the various arguments and evidences for the Mythicist position, the arguments from Silence in Paul's letters and contemporary history, the arguments from similarity among previous and contemporary myths and legends, and also arguments from ahistoricity, which are based on specific biblical passages and attributes of the Bible. But now we're going to raise the discussion, hopefully to a bit of a higher level, and to address some of the questions that relate to the ramifications of the Mythicist hypothesis on and to the Christian worldview itself, rather than specific points of the hypothesis. So the bulk of these questions are actually borrowed from the historian Richard Carrier, who had attempted to use them, albeit unsuccessfully for some other reasons, in a discussion that he had with Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona. I thought that they really didn't get the attention they rightly deserved, and he actually agrees. So I'd like to shine them off for a bit of another go-around here at Apologia. But before we get into his, I think a more interesting way to start this whole process, this whole discussion, is just to ask, all right, now we've looked at all these evidences and arguments, you know, sort of ad nauseum, not quite, you know, there's a little bit more depth that we could have gotten into, but we've surveyed them pretty well. But Kevin and John, and maybe Kevin, you want to start off with this, how do you, as a Christian, really communicate and explain these various evidences and arguments, everything that builds into the Mythicist position, how do you explain that to other Christians?
Try to, I think, first of all, to just explain the historical method. What is it? What is it not? What are the tests for historicity in determining anything from the ancient world or even more recent history? And I think people generally have a kind of a poor knowledge of that. And as a non-historian, sometimes I'm fascinated by some of the things that I read that the historians actually do to determine historical events, some of the things that they have to wade for, some of the things that they have to look for, and so on. And so I think it would begin by saying, well, what do we mean by history? What do we mean by the historical method? What do we mean by test for historicity? What do professional historians do to determine, ancient events? And so once we get that, and we at least level the playing field where we can look at the historical evidence for Jesus using these criteria, and using criteria that the professional historians use and so on. And so I think a good starting point would be a discussion of the historical method. These days, Christians and non-Christians are affected by kind of a postmodern skepticism of historicity, of the historical method, of history. And again, it's kind of unwarranted. It's part of the postmodernism that we all complain about, and that is revisionism has actually become kind of popular. And it's become rather popular to just doubt history. Well, I think that a lot of that historical skepticism is unwarranted, and a lot of people would agree. And hopefully that will wane as postmodernism wanes. We are getting indications that postmodernism is really waning. It's going to take a while to get out of culture. No telling how long, but postmodernism is very, very skeptical about the concept of truth. Postmodernism has a tendency to impose modern views, I mean contemporary views, onto ancient views, and and so on. You see that in movies, you see it in literature and in art, and so on. So it's kind of a revisionism that I hope will go away. Those are two issues that come up right up top, Zach, and that is, you know, what is the historical method, and what about this tendency toward revisionism that we've had lately?
So is I just sort of getting into the various parts of the hypothesis. Is there one, like, where would you start? I guess if you were, I mean, aside from providing a sort of background information, which, I mean, when you put your toe in the water, on what side do you put it in?
Probably on the side of the New Testament documents. I think that what we often hear, and what the Christian will often hear, is that, okay, yeah, I'd be more than willing to look at the history of Jesus, as long as it's not your Bible, as long as it's not the New Testament. And so my first question, you know, back on that would be, well, okay, but why are you penalizing the New Testament documents? Well, because they're religious, and we could go through all the objections that come up. Oh, because they have miracle stories. Well, they were biased. They had an agenda. And you go through that, and rather than deal with all those objections now, because those apply to anything from the ancient world that we find in as far as history, I would just probably start with the primary evidence for Jesus, and that would be the New Testament. So the question then at that become is, would become, are the New Testament documents handed down to us out of the first century, are they reliable? Do they have the marks of historicity? And I would deal with that first. And I would make a case for the historicity and the accuracy and the reliability of the New Testament documents. I wouldn't go to inspiration. That's going to be further down the road. You don't have to assume inerrancy or inspiration or the nature of inspiration or the definition of inerrancy yet. That'll get down the road. Let's start with some basic reliability. And then go from there. The corroborative evidence, that is evidence outside of the New Testament from Roman and Greek writers, Jewish writers, and historians, outside of the New Testament, we want to look at that as well. That can only be corroborative, because the primary and the bulk of the evidence, of course, is in the New Testament. So, toe goes in the water on the side of, are the New Testament documents reliable?
So you're saying that you really want to, before you even address the mythicist hypothesis, you want to make sure that you have a positive case for historicity. But isn't this already sort of part of the Christian worldview, the Christian mindset?
Yeah, to the extent that it hasn't been clouded again by kind of a revisionistic or postmodern skepticism that could have even been, you know, affected in the church. But, you know, I would try to explain the Jesus mythicist hypothesis, from its strengths. In other words, what is the evidence that Jesus is mythical, that Jesus didn't exist? You know, but before we can even examine that, we need to look at, some of the historical considerations as to why that might be the case. So, It keeps getting me back to historical methodology, test for historicity, and so on. And I think all the other issues would kind of fall underneath that. Like, well, you know, what about the legendary embellishment? What about borrowing from other pagan myths and everything? To come up with this character that we find in the New Testament, that we find in Christianity, and so on. all of that still kind of gets back to how historians do history. What about miracle claims? You know, how is the historian going to examine miracle claims? Or are they ruled off limits a priori? You know, and so, boy, I you know, it's kind of a big old obstacle to get around, and that is historical method and so on.
So, which of, I guess which, I know where you're starting, so which would you say for last? Which do you think is the most difficult aspect of the hypothesis to grapple with as a Christian?
You know, when I look at the parallels, sometimes they seem rather convincing. It seems to be, you know, wow. There do seem to be some, you know, some parallels and similarities here that could lend to the embellishment or creation of a character based on other characters in the ancient world. When I first started hearing about that hypothesis, it's nothing new. It's been dealt, you know, it's been around for a long time, but at least 100 years. That is difficult to unpack because in a short period of time, you need to go to first century Palestine and see what kind of you know, pagan influences and pagan religious practices could have influenced thought. And as to what is difficult, it's also difficult when I think about Justin Martyr.
Yeah.
When you read what he said, at first blush, it looks like he's saying, "Oh, come on, you know, you guys got all your myths, you know, and we have Jesus." It's almost like he's saying, "Look, don't you see the similarities?" At first blush, that looks like even he was kind of bowing to that borrowing, that savior God, you know, legendary embellishment, everything. Now, we've talked about it on this podcast before and, you know, discussed how he was saying, look, he's making an appeal to the government. Why are you persecuting Christians when you've got pagans out there who believe similar things? And not that he was making a case for Jesus being borrowed, you know, and things like that. But when you first read that at first blush, so I think that's it, Zach. It takes a while to explore all that and to explain it, and to kind of unpack all the variables that exist because of that problem.
Gotcha.
Am I answering really? Am I going to the strongest argument there? You know, you think?
In my opinion,
yeah.
I don't know, but I agree with you that I think that's probably the one that's most troubling for Christians, simply because I can imagine there being a real emotional sort of disconnect that it'd be incredibly emotionally troubling to consider the possibility that Jesus is just. I don't want to say a knockoff, but unoriginal, you know, I can see that being, especially, you know, in mainstream evangelical Christianity, you know, so much is put into the personal relationship with Jesus. And, you know, and so the parallelism, I mean, the whole hypothesis really sort of attacks the idea of Jesus being a real historical person, but the parallels, sort of, they don't just attack the idea of it, they attack the very icon, I guess, of it, the attributes, you know, the things that we associate with Jesus and his personality and his character and the things that he did. And, you know, making the argument for that to be unoriginal, I think has more emotional weight, if not necessarily intellectual weight. But I think that's definitely one that's troubling. What do you think, John? Where would you start if you were if you had a fellow Christian that was just starting off with this and you were trying to guide them through it, where would you start and where would you end?
Really, I would try to begin laying out an overview of what the position entails, from the arguments from similarity, the biblical ahistoricity, and the arguments from silence, like that are posted on the Apologia blog, and just give them all of this and say, here's kind of everything that's going on, just so I think it's good to always take an overview approach to something to get the big picture and start off with that, because I think sometimes in getting too detailed too quickly, we can lose sight of the big picture. And if we have the big picture in mind, then it's easier to recall that as we're digging into the details and remember, oh, this is part of this whole thing. Oh, and I remember this part. This is going to influence this as well. And in that way, I think there aren't as many surprises. But after the overview, I'd focus in on pretty much any and all things concerning the historical reliability of the Gospels. I'm with Kevin on that one. I think if we're going to say, here's this position, what is it up against? Because it's in effect, a negative position. It's saying X is not the case. And so we go, okay, well, what is X? And so I think looking at what exactly is being addressed, that's where we need to start, the reliability of the Gospels, and then go into the exegetical issues. And then from there, once those details are spelled out, then we can say, okay, well, now that we have the details within the Gospel accounts, how are these similar? What could have been pulled from the archetypes, etc.?
Hey, and Zach and John, let me give you a good example of the emotional impact.
Yeah.
Too. If you've ever heard the Farrell Till Norman Geisler debate on the resurrection, they bust in on buses. You know, I mean, churches from all over. That was a well attended debate.
Yeah.
And mostly Christians, and but when Farrell Till said, "Ladies and gentlemen, dying and rising savior gods in the ancient world were a dime a dozen."
Dime a dozen, yeah.
You could have heard a pin drop, you know. And Geisler's really didn't spend a lot of time on it. He blew it off as unhistorical and not consensus. He said, look, Frazier's golden bough theory is at least a century old. And all those pagan saviors were in a reincarnation setting and not in a Jewish setting. But it went fast, and the ringing, that sentence just continued to ring. And when I first heard that debate years ago, I said, "What? I wasn't even familiar with that dying and rising God parallelism yet." When I first heard it, I said, "Well, that can't be true." You know, so it does have an emotional impact.
Yeah,
and it caused me immediately to start looking and studying. That's been the focus of my attention for a long time, because it's got a certain appeal to it. Again, it gets us back to, however, well, you know, what does history tell us, and how do we discern those facts and so on, but. You could have heard a pin drop, you know.
Yeah, that's clearly why, you know, Brian Fleming chose that to focus on in his, you know, God that wasn't there. It's gotten, you know, some criticism for only painting part of the picture, but you got to admit, you know, he painted a real, you know, there's a lot of emotional, you know, content and imagery. I mean, he spent a lot of time focusing on the passion of the Christ and highlighting, you know, violence, you know, in Christianity. It's very sort of gut wrenching movie to watch, I guess, if you're a Christian.
Yeah, it really does.
Absolutely. Well, that's a really good introduction. And I think that what we'll do now is we'll start getting into some of the questions that Richard Carrier had, from his discussion. And I'll just read them off, and Kevin, you can respond, and then John, you can go ahead and give your thoughts too. I know you've thought about these quite a bit. So, question one: in the Book of Acts, the apostles are having vivid and powerful visions and dream communications from God all the time. We hear of similar experiences reported in that era from Jews and pagans, who were also having vivid and powerful visions and dream communications from a variety of gods and angels. Why isn't this happening now? And why was that happening back then, even to pagans and Jews who weren't seeing and hearing what the Christians were seeing and hearing?
Okay, but John, I'll defer to you. You know, I have some answers on that, but I'd like for you to go ahead and start that off, since I've done a lot of talking, if you don't mind.
Oh, cool, sure, okay. When I immediately started... When I was reading this at first and going through this question, looking at Carrier's comments on this, for some reason it was interesting. I immediately thought of Exodus 9 and Moses' interaction with Pharaoh, and Moses is relaying a message to Pharaoh from God. And it's Exodus 9:15 through 16, where he says, "For if by now I had put forth my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, you would then have been cut off from the earth. But indeed, for this reason, I have allowed you to remain in order to show you my power and in order to proclaim my name through all the earth." And why I thought of this was, there were so many times in reading through Exodus, and it's such a great story. It's just that it's great to go back to and read everything that transpires. And one question that always just hits me, and it's, you know, it's nothing serious, but it's just kind of one of those things. I'm just like, why go through all this trouble? Why not just be like, okay, look, God's really angry, and this is going to go very badly, really quickly. Just letting you know, the whole nation's going to be gone, and just wipe everybody out, just get rid of them. And the Israelites just kind of go on their way, and they're singing. And I always thought, why go through 10 plagues? Why go through the magic at the beginning? Why, for Moses, would he have to go through the embarrassment of saying, "Oh yeah, you don't believe me? Watch my staff." And then throws the staff down, and some, you know, there's a snake, and then the magicians are like, "Is this guy a joke? You know, is he kidding?" And then they do the same thing, and he's like, Oh yeah, we'll check this out, you know. And there's that little time where Moses will do a couple things, and I mean, I can just read the tension into that of Moses going, this is not working out so well, and having to go through that, and then going through the plagues, and just like, why not just end this? And God gives the answer to that, where he says, "For this reason I have allowed you to remain, in order to show you my power, and in order to proclaim my name through all the earth." Now, while this doesn't answer every single question that we might have, and it doesn't totally explain everything, at least Moses has a reasoning behind it. You know, at least there's something there, even if it's not clear. And so why I thought of this in relation to this kind of question is, whatever's being conveyed through dreams, through visions, even if these people don't recognize it, you know, and I'll get to this in a second. It's not every time, but obviously there are some people who are like, "Oh, I had a vision. Who is it from?" I think it might have been from Zeus, but I'm not quite sure, you know. And we have these kinds of things going on. I don't think it's unreasonable to think, well, if God had, and I know I'm presupposing a lot, but I kind of have to, if God had a specific purpose for these things, it does not necessitate that he communicate the same exact thing to both parties, to where if you were to get these people together, they'd be able to say, "Oh, you heard that too. Oh, well, so did I. Oh, isn't that nice?" Nothing requires that. And whereas we look at communication and an overall plan is being spelled out and everybody knows what's going on and everyone's, you know, on the same page, what we're talking about is something quite a bit larger than, you know, things that we normally talk about. And so communication can be totally different. And what I was tying that into this next point, it isn't always the case that things that Jews or pagans, or, you know, Muslims or whoever else, the visions that they're getting are going to always be different things, or that they're not from the Christian God per se. Indeed, I've heard multiple accounts, a number of them firsthand, from people that I know, that I trust, that are all together with it, who say, man, I just got back from Africa. I'm like, oh, how did Africa go? Africa was amazing. We went to this village, and we had to go with this other tribe to go to this village. And this village did not speak English, and we were scared because we didn't know what was going on. And this village took us to this other village, and they communicated with each other. And we were able to, you know, talk to the village we went with, and they translated, and they said, oh, these people knew you were coming. Well, how did these people know where we were coming? Well, they had a vision. Well, that's awfully convenient. What was their vision? They said you're going to come and tell them about somebody that was going to save them or something. You know, and you hear things like this, and it's like, yeah, they're kidding me. And I've read accounts of, you know, missionaries going into Asia and meeting these tribes and stuff that said, oh, yes, we saw a man, and he said his name is such and such, and when it's translated, it's Jesus, and he told us about you, and we're so glad you're here. Here's some food. And you hear things like this, and so I think it's it doesn't tell the whole story, really, to say, well, how come these things don't happen now? How can we never see this now? It's like, well, you know, however incredible these accounts may be, you know, people are, there are people that are saying they're happening.
Well, so, I think that, let me just say this, that I think that the thrust of Richard's question is, you know, if it kind of gets back to parallelism again, you know,
we have all
these accounts in the ancient world, and why are we to say that the accounts in Acts are any different when the Old Testament is rife with these? So we're back to the old dime a dozen argument again. And, you know, even if it were the case that we had these multiple accounts of visions and religious oracles and religious fervor and things like that, it still may be the case that some of them are veridical. So let's take our miracle accounts. Let's take our just like we would any other historical account. Let's take them on a case by case basis, and let's look at the religio historical context as Pannenberg, probably one of the greatest German theologians living today, says. The religio historical context can lend weight to the evidence. Not prove, but it can lend weight on the side of miracle claims when there is a religio-historical context that bolsters it, that shows that there are other things happening that also seem to be that go around that lend support. I'm sorry, I've got my little girl here who's pulling one leg of mine, and so I lost my train of thought. But anyway, and so that's one thing we would look at. And then, again, he asked, and come on, why aren't these happening today? And that question is asked a lot. I think it's a good question. It's, you know, why isn't God doing more, you know, Red Sea partings, and why aren't there more visions and things like that? It gets too quickly, and I'll just spend a little bit of time on this quickly, and that is, kind of gets down to, as John was saying, along the lines of the hiddenness of God questions. Why isn't God more obvious? It's an internal question. If God exists, how ought he reveal himself? What would be the most effective way, according to God, to his knowledge and everything? How should he reveal himself? And I'll say with John as well, we are hearing amazing stories. I've talked to one man personally, and again, this is, you can call it hearsay, whatever, but we're hearing amazing stories of Christ appearing to people in isolated countries, in Muslim countries, that are just absolutely cut off and isolated from the gospel. And yet, we do hear these stories. Of Christ appearing to them, of Christ appearing to an entire village. Now, the skeptic in me and the investigator in me would like to research these, obviously. But I'm like, John, and then I hear these from reliable people, people I consider to be reliable. You would have to take those stories on a case-by-case basis as well. Otherwise, you're just believing what somebody says blindly.
So, but I think also part of what this is getting into is sort of one of the fundamental principles of the historical method is the principle of analogy, historical analogy. So, you know, in the what we read about happening to the early church was that these visions were happening to the central characters. You know, these were happening to Peter. These were happening to, you know, Paul. The people that were steering the church, the top guys. And so what you're talking about now, these appearances and visions, they're happening in, you know, backwaters in Africa. So there's still a contrast there that I'm not sure what to make of it. You know, why is the context at the beginning of the church was for these visions and things to form the church and to give it instruction in terms of, you know, doctrine and, you know, what the proper, you know, orthodoxy should be. Whereas now it's just, you know, weird little confirmatory visions. I mean, is there any sort of revelation that's coming out of these, or?
Well, you know, I think that probably gets more toward the second question, even though there is an overlap that Richard had for Habermas and Lacuna, and that is, you know, why didn't Jesus appear to the entire Sanhedrin or to the Roman Council or, you know, to the leaders? Why did he only appear to the disciples? But what I meant by what Pannenberg means by the religio-historical context is exactly what you said, Zach. That is, you know, it was to give instruction and aid in the founding of the church as necessary. There was no canon of scripture yet, and everything to give them that boost and that push start and the whole bit. But even further back than that, what are the other religio historical contexts that could go back hundreds and hundreds of years and other circumstances that could be brought to bear on that so-called miracle claim? So it would take us too long to do that, but you know, systematically, I think that you could look at what would lend weight to the evidence for these things as opposed to claims in an opposing worldview. And so this is what Hume called self-canceling miracles. If you've got miracles in one religion that verify that religion, and then a contradictory religion, a religion that teaches just the opposite on a lot of things, or it claims to be the only way, you've got miracles in them, you know, which self-authenticating, which verifying miracles are we to believe?
Right.
At that point, you've got to say, fine, yeah. You got a problem there. But we've yet to see that there are, in fact, miracles that are verifying miracles in all religions or even in two and so on.
Okay.
You know, we would still need to kind of take a look at that.
All right. Well, now Kevin has to leave us due to some previous obligations. So he'll be leaving the discussion, but
I appreciate you guys.
All right.
I'm sorry I can't stay longer.
All right. See you, Kevin.
Okay.
See you later, Kevin.
At this point, I'd like to bring in Dan Sawyer, who will be joining us a tad bit late, but we'll bring him right up to speed. Hey, Dan, how are you? Excellent.
So what if I missed?
I started off with how do you as Christians communicate these evidences to other Christians? So there's some discussion on that. We don't really have to revisit that because that's really just getting their perspective, I guess, unless there's something you want to weigh in on.
What was the
initially? How does a Christian teach this to other Christians? Where do you start? What do you say for last? That kind of stuff.
Well, I suppose it depends on what your goal is. If your goal is to inoculate, you'd teach it in a way completely different from if your goal is to inquire. As far as inoculation, Dallas Theological Seminary has a fabulous inoculation program when it comes to this stuff. No, I'm serious. They're very, very good at teaching the weakest form of the other side's argument, so that when you encounter the strong form, you pretty much automatically discount it, because the weak form isn't so weak that it's facile. It's just weak enough that, that you can get in under the edges of it.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, I'm actually trying to set up a meeting with Dr. Daryl Bach to talk to him. I emailed him and I said, "Hey, I've been reading some Bob Price, and I just wanted to ask you about it." And he's like, "Set something up with me. Let's do it." So,
Daryl Bach. Wow, I haven't seen him in about 15, 20 years.
Definitely, let us know how that goes, or write something up about it.
I don't think you remember me. I was like 10 years old at the time.
Yeah. But, he seems, I saw him at Grace Bible in College Station talking about the Da Vinci Code and the Gospel of Thomas. And of course, you know, as Christians, we were all freaked out. And he was like, no. Don't freak out. And, and he laid it out really well. He's an excellent communicator. And
oh, he is. He's a very, very sweet guy.
Yeah. And he just seemed really, really knowledgeable, especially he's one of those guys that makes me sick. My memory's terrible. And like, you could just, so what do you think about this? And be like, well, actually, I think such and such, and this happened in 86, but some people think it was 87, but this guy, and he just just can spout out information and just really intelligent. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to go to the top here and I'm going to see what all he has to say. So
absolutely.
I'll let y'all know how it goes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, question number two from the Richard Carrier list. This might sound like a frivolous question, but it really isn't. I mean it quite seriously. Why does God give me more evidence that smoking cigarettes is harmful than he gives me that Jesus lives? John?
Well, I was wondering how I could approach this. And as Dan pointed out, I think the second time we did this, reformed thinking in me is just going to come out no matter what. So I figured, hey, why fight it? And and so I take that view on this. I'm going to take that angle, and it's really in the questioning. It's really I was surprised how personal the question it is when you really look at it. You know, why doesn't he give me more evidence? And this is one of the things I really like about Richard Carrier is he doesn't ask these questions or pose these things from this far off, distant, well, it's simply this academic such and whatever. I mean, he's really personal with it. It's really cool. So I really enjoyed this list, but that's kind of where I started with this, was the personal aspect of it. And I thought of Matthew 28, where Jesus tells the disciples, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations." And this is an interesting discussion within Christian circles, because I, for one, am not a big fan of the track approach of, look, all right, guys, let's go do this. We're going to invest 0.38 seconds in someone's eternity by handing them this paper. And while I've heard stories, you know, and I've met people that said, you know what, I was walking through a parking lot, I saw this piece of paper on the ground, and it happened to be this track, and it showed the bridge, and there's God on the bridge, and then I'm on the other side of the bridge, and then there's Satan on it, you know, and, you know, and I saw that, and it really just, it hit me, and now I'm a believer, and that's cool. And I think God can certainly do that. What we're commanded to do is to make disciples, and what we see in terms of the best example of making and molding and shaping disciples is Jesus' disciples themselves, where they had this 3-year internship watching Jesus live. Their lives were changed. They abandoned their jobs and social lives, and everything was about this. And he stayed with them for a very long time, you know, in terms of actually pouring into individuals, 3 years is a long time. And so why I'm building up all of this is I don't see the idea in Scripture that God's purpose for anything that he did was so that every person will have the opportunity to believe. And I know I've just lost half of my believing friends listening to this, and I get ripped for it all the time. But when we're looking at this question, in Mark chapter 4 is a perfect example where Jesus has been speaking in parables, and the disciples were like, "Why is it that you speak in these parables?" And sorry, my wife's leaving. And so, you know, why is it that you're doing this? And he says, you know, effectively, well, so they won't understand me. And this floors so many people, and the scrambling to do so much theological, you know, twisting and scripture editing to make this make sense in a view that says, no, God wants everyone to hear it. Everyone will hear it. They'll get their shot. They'll have their chance. And if they're too stupid, well, then, you know, quite literally to hell with them. And so, I think it's incredibly difficult to get around this. And, you know, there are times where Jesus is healing people and, he tells the disciples, okay, let's pack it up. Let's go. And he's in this crowded house where sick people are pushing in all around. And I mean, I can't imagine the instances where this was the case, quite often, where you have all these people, but he doesn't heal everyone. He doesn't talk to every woman at every well. He doesn't heal every paralytic or blind guy. And he's very purposeful in a very specific task in communicating to very specific people. And so I think that is where the answer has to come, is in looking at, okay, well, what was the purpose? And I think had Christ redeemed one person, then that is enough, because through one person we fell. And through one person could things be redeemed. Indeed, having defeated death by himself, he defeated death. It's not like he needed, well, if I get five guys, then death's really defeated. You know,
it sounds very like you're arguing for an Arminian universalist stance, which I agree is internally consistent, but it sure ain't evangelical.
Arguing for an Arminian?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Arminian universalism. You sound like you're very definitely going down that road.
Well, no, actually, I'm trying.
I think he's trying to give you the other road. The Calvinist. No. I think you're going for the limited atonement, right?
Yes, that's actually.
You're really trying.
And so that's what I'm saying. Like it, from that viewpoint, what I think Scripture says, and I could be wrong about this. I'm very fervent and I love the doctrine of election, but I could be wrong. But I think that provides the answer. God doesn't reveal himself to everyone because there are those that he has chosen from eternity that he will redeem, that will be his. And there are others that he does not. And
because of election, the believability of the gospel is not important in your paradigm, is not important as the pietist paradigm would lead us to believe, because God chooses who he wants regardless of what they believe.
Now, I don't...
Are you willing to go that far with it or not quite?
No, because I still think that there is, that the gospels, are still believable. And I think that that is something to defend, and that is something to stand for, and I think it's important. Now, but the point that I'm making is Carrier's question is, why does God give me more evidence that smoking cigarettes is harmful than he gives me that Jesus lives? As if he had enough evidence, then he would definitely believe. what we see in John, where Jesus says that, you know, there are these people that see me doing these things and they don't believe. Or when he was ascending into heaven, it said there were some standing around that, you know, and some doubted. And it's like, I mean, really? Are you really doubting? He's floating up into the sky and you're doubting, you know? And so I don't think enough evidence is going to really do the trick. How much evidence do we need? You know,
well, goes on forever. So maybe this is a subtle clarification. Are you saying that there is enough evidence, but it's just inaccessible to the unelect? Or are you saying that God only provides the evidence to the elect?
I mean, I can see. Okay, yeah, that is very subtle. I haven't quite worked that one out yet. If I'm going to shoot from the hip on that one, and I know it's dangerous.
Okay.
But I've got to give you something. I think because we see different instances of people who, you know, I mean, it's all throughout the church where people know nothing about historical evidence or reliability. They believe because they believe because they believe. Mm. And I've met people who they're like, well, I was an atheist for 35 years and I did the research and I debated so-and-so. And you, these stories where these people just, they keep looking at the evidence and they keep looking at the evidence. I mean, the same evidence available to you and Dan and Carrier and everybody else. And they look at it. And at one point they go, you know what? This really is overwhelming to me. And this is so much evidence. I don't know what to do with it. And, you know, and then in the case of like Bart Ehrman or something who believed and he was, you know, studied under Metzger and, you know, eventually that evidence kind of wore down and he said, you know what, there's not enough evidence for me. And so that's a really hard question to answer.
It almost sounds like you're saying that it's really independent of the evidence. This is almost a question that not can't be answered, but it's immaterial to, I guess, the larger question of being saved versus not being saved, which is kind of implicit in how Carrier phrases it, I guess.
Well, when Carrier was here and we were talking about, we touched on this issue when I was doing the interview with him for the Reprobates Hour, and he said that what it boils down to for him is the question of warrant. When are you ethically, when are you in a position where you can ethically say, I believe this, but not that? When it comes to religion, or when it comes to anything really, but with religion, the question of warrant is difficult because in every religion, you have people who believe because they believe. They were raised that way. That's the reality with which they were presented. They've accepted it because it makes sense to them from the world they grew up in. But, you know, in any one religion, if there was only one religion, that might be enough. It's when you live in a world where there are not just different flavors of Christianity, but there are thousands of sects of Hinduism, of Islam, of all sorts of different religions, all of whom have their fervent faithful and their holy people who are to all appearances as laudable as others, who teach very similar lessons as far as basic ethics goes, though when it comes down to specific contextualization, they go different directions. Mm-hmm. So we're warranted believing that cigarettes cause cancer. We've done experiments. We can point to the evidence that this raises the risk by this many percentage points, is statistically significant. Therefore, it's safe to say it's a causal agent in at least a certain percentage of the population. But we don't have that kind of evidence, at least from my perspective, from Carrier's perspective, and I think probably from Zach's perspective, that would give us the warrant to rule, to give a verdict on the question of, is Christianity true or is Hinduism true? Are the Jains correct or the Buddhists? And I think that's the direction that question is coming from.
So it really amounts to an epistemological issue.
Right.
Okay.
And it becomes a personal moral issue when you ask if God cared what his people believed, if that was the key for their salvation, why then would he leave things at such a muddle?
Gotcha.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I obviously the the approach that I'm trying to take is not so much, it's less, I'm not going to say it's not, but it's less a content issue. And it's more of a, you know, I mean, obviously I'm coming from a worldview that says we're fallen, even if we have every bit of evidence in the world that just makes absolute perfect sense to, you know, according to whatever, you know, logical system is in place, you know, are we still going to believe worldview? Sorry, I thought a survey says, you know, but, right. You know, worldview says no, and that's not the case. And so it's, and yeah, and I know it's a really difficult thing. And I actually do go back and forth sometimes of, okay, well, now wait a minute. This makes sense. This makes a little more sense this way, but you know, and, so that's, it's a tough issue.
If I could sidetrack off on a rabbit trail for a second, that are you familiar with C.S. Lewis's solution to this problem?
To this question that Richard Carrier poses?
Right. The question of warrant and, particularly with pertaining to choosing which religion is right and that kind of thing.
I don't, once you say it, I might, because I'm sure it's been on some t-shirt at A&M, but not off the top of my head.
Well, Lewis's solution was that the important part of the spiritual life is the fact that there is a spiritual life, and that the act of worship, of seeking, of devotion is an act of faith, even if the seeker or the devotee or the worshiper does not know to whom that is directed.
So he held that, because
faith is the evidence of things not seen, and faith is seen in Paul's letters as God's gift to the elect, then all those who have faith in anything are indeed the faithful, and they're the elect even if they don't know it.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm not willing to go there. there's a passage that I say this every time, and I'm prideful, so I'm going to defend myself. I'm horrible with scriptural references, but I'm thinking of a passage that says, Who will respond if the trumpet call is indistinct? Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's not ringing a bell so far.
Yeah, I'm killing it. I'm killing it. But what I get from spreading the gospel is that those whom God has elected will hear the gospel. That's okay. What so far I've understood, and that may be wrong. But you know, as even in my, I guess, I don't know what Calvinism, I'm still pretty young in that. So I'm still working a lot of these issues out and wrestling with them. And doubting and, you know, all that whole cycle. But, that's what I understand. So but at least knee jerk reaction, I'm not willing to go so far as to say, you know, oh, the Spirit kind of does this thing everywhere and people can worship whoever or whatever. And then it just kind of ends up being okay in the end. And, oh, that's right. I remember the reference now. It's from, he makes mention of that in the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes, the last battle.
That's right. Okay, I knew that sounded familiar. Yeah,
He also makes mention of it in the Screwtape letters, I think in letter 23.
So does he?
Yeah, he's more explicit about it there, actually. He says it's, we fight under terrible, I'm trying to quote from memory, so it might not be quite right. He says, Screwtape says to Wormwood, we fight under terrible conditions because he has filled their world with beauty and pleasures that all point back to him. And he cares not with what they believe as long as they believe. And so long as the desire for them to walk on their own is there, he is pleased even with their stumbles.
Yeah, that was not on any t-shirts at A&M, actually.
So basically, if I can sum your position up, whatever the epistemological ramifications that Carrier himself or whomever is asking this question, whatever ramifications they have to deal with, the reason why they don't have the evidence is because if they don't have the evidence, then for whatever reason, that means that they're not elect.
I think so.
Okay.
I think that's what I'm trying to say. And I actually had a little tidbit on addressing his comment about William Lane Craig.
Mm.
What's the quote here? William Lane Craig told him that his cognitive faculties were not functioning properly, and that is why I wasn't convinced by the evidence. I don't know if that's what Mike believes, but he, let's see, apparently, Carrier took it kind of hard, you know, and I understand from, I don't want to say from the outside, that sounds bad, but from, in the context of a different worldview, if someone says to you, well, look, man, you just obviously don't see it, you know, it's like,
your brain's not working right.
Yeah, it's kind of like, wow, screw you. You know, I mean, someone's, look, you're just stupid, clearly, you know. But I think, you know, once we go, okay, well, wait a minute, you know, what does Bill Craig believe, you know, or what do I believe, you know, he puts himself in that same boat. And that's what any Christian should do. And I wanted to get personal here for a second, that all of this, it should never be presented this way. And if our attitude is ever this way, shame on us. It should never be this way. Mm. And if I'm ever this way, point it out to me, because that's not what I want.
Okay.
I'm not speaking for, it's not as if I was given enough sets of propositions where I go, oh yeah, obviously, you know, well, now I believe, you know, and that's, I guess, part of the draw. If I'm going to speak, you know, apart from scriptural evidence, if there's any appeal to a Calvinist position, it's because I don't want to take credit for that. It's not as if I'm brighter. I'm not smarter. It's not, I wasn't leaning toward God at that time. It's not like I entered a church and it's like, this is really cool. It's something else happened. And, you know, it is a frustrating concept and it's a frustrating idea, but I don't think Craig was doing this. I think Craig's point is, well, you know what my worldview is, and that worldview says all of us are in this position here. None of us are going to get it. It's not like I'm smarter than you are. I was in the exact same boat. I was pulled out of that boat for reasons unbeknownst to me. It's not like I convinced myself or, you know, or anything, or I figured out the math better than you did, you know? And so I hope that, I hope that's understood at least by y'all. And I hope whoever listens can hopefully understand that we're speaking from a position that says, hey man, I didn't do anything here.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next question. So we can keep on going through this list. This is actually a set of three. The following three questions are all closely related and really amount to just one question. Why did the risen Jesus only appear to his followers and to only one previously obscure enemy among the thousands opposing his gospel? Why didn't he appear to Pilate or Herod or Caiaphas or the Roman Senate? We sort of touched on this before. Why didn't he also appear to deliver the gospel to China or to the Americas as the Mormons claim he did? And, this is more or less the type of question that I guess you would expect from a guy like Carrier. But what's your take on this, John?
Well, it seems to me it's kind of it looks like two and three tie together here. Three is, you know, following up from two, and I really don't have a whole lot to expand on that. And hopefully, one of you can point something out that I'm probably missing. And it helps me to have something prepared from question two, because as far as the history goes, I'm not that sharp on it. So, really, my response when I first read it is, well, why would he or should he have? Why better if he did appear to those people? And the only answer I could come up with was, well, it would give more evidence. Well, mm-hmm. Then now we're kind of back to the second question. And it's the way I phrased it here, I've written something down. I said, the evidence bearing on any particular decision about God has its own weight according to God's purposes, nothing more and nothing less. It is what it is because of how God structured it. And so we would be assuming a certain view, you know, that God wanted to make a case, you know, this way. But I think sometimes the questions are, some of these questions sometimes are rigged. And I'm not intentionally, I don't mean that harshly, but I think a significant part of the response is going to presuppose so much of what I already believe. And where it seems like, you know, I'm copping out or, oh, look, you're just dodging this here. It's like, well, not really, because this, you know, my response is the directive behind everything else. So it's like, well, why would God do it this way? Well, heck if I know, you know, I have no clue, you know, maybe one day I'll know. And it's kind of one of those things where, why did God choose to do X this way and not this way? And I mean, it's really one of those deals where God has a specific purpose for something. He did something a certain way. He chose to act this way and not this way. And if we remove that element, if we say, okay, well, look, you can't just say that because that's a cop-out or that's dodging the issue. It's like, well, apart from that, I mean, this whole thing doesn't even really make sense anyway. And so I kind of have to presuppose that to answer it adequately.
Can I tell you why that's not intellectually satisfactory for someone coming from our worldview?
Mm-hmm.
The reason is that the Bible says that Jesus had certain things going on as far as goals that he was going to achieve, what his mission was. God loved the world and gave his son to redeem the world. Paul's message is also of universal salvation, of turning back the sin of Adam. It is a race-wide message. But Jesus's actions and the actions of the church following that do not bear that claim out. And that's one of the things Calvin was trying to solve with his doctrine of election. Coming at it from the outside, or even having been on the inside, and this being one of the things that helped push me to the outside, it seems that there is a claim advanced that doesn't hold up. And then when asked why it doesn't hold up, there are generally one or two apologetic responses. One of them is to take the claim back to a more primitive type of level, which is what Calvin did. He took a universal claim and he scaled it back to a God's caprice claim. You know, God saves those whom he wants to. And, or to, go to a God's ways are mysterious and we don't have any way to judge that. And basically to resign from the conversation on the basis of divine mystery. That's why the question is as it is, and why the response you just gave feels unsatisfactory. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I'm glad you said that. I said at the beginning, you know, there might be something else that I'm not quite hitting on here. I'm really glad you said that, because I want to do this question justice. if Richard Carrier thought it was important, it must be, and I'm just missing it. So I guess, could you help me understand, I guess, the thrust of the question, and what, I guess, more specifically, what he was asking?
Okay. The three questions all presuppose that Jesus came to die to atone for the sins of the world, mm-hmm. and that his great commission was to go and make disciples of all nations, to baptize the world, to win the world for God. Now, with that as the premise, Carrier looks at the Gospels, and they're exceedingly local. They're exceedingly modest. Even when you get into Acts and the Roman and the empire-wide missionary mission, Christianity doesn't have growth rates that are different from Mormonism or Islam. They all follow the same basic kind of population saturation curve for the first three centuries. And if Jesus was in the business of saving the world, and the knowledge of what he did was essential for that salvation, both assumptions have to be in play. then why did he not appear before the Senate or before Caiaphas or before his enemies, whom he prayed that God would forgive? Why only to the very small group of followers? Why in such an intensely local way? And why then did his followers do such a poor job at carrying out his commission that he had to go and find Paul?
That's an interesting. Okay, now I see better. I see better what you mean. From what I understand. Go ahead. What?
And I forgot the last question here is kind of the capstone of that. Why did he not go to America or to the Far East? Why did it take 1500 years from the time he died till the time his message reached these shores, and then in the mouths of conquerors rather than in the mouths of the of compassionate?
If it was a truly universal
exactly
message, yeah.
That's a good question. I hate to leave it.
Well,
I misunderstood. I guess
that's all right.
I misunderstood the thrust of what was going on. I thought it was a general like, why would God do this? Like, hell, I don't know. You know, but
God do this based on the way that based on what the religion purports itself to be? Why does it then behave in this manner?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to go through and do some serious exegeting of some texts. And
well, I think. Similar to what you've done with some of the other questions. I mean, I think, like Dan was saying, the Calvinist response is dealing with this, I think. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I wanted to provide a little bit more, because I think with Paul, I mean, there's a particular reason why he chose Paul and why Paul, you know, Paul was an enemy and he did appear to Paul. And, you know, maybe, you know, because Paul did end up going into other areas. So maybe that was part of, you know, Jesus going into those areas. And then was it Thomas who went into India and, and different things like these. Now, as far as beyond that, why didn't he go to China or Australia or Antarctica? I have no clue. There may be accounts of other things that, you know, I'm not aware of or something. So I'll have to do more digging.
Mm.
To see if I can come up with any kind of adequate response to those. But I mean, I'm prepared to say, hey, there may not be. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it can always be the response that it was not part of God's plan. I mean, that's always the...
Which is not satisfactory, but it at least...
I understand that. It's not satisfactory to me, but it is at least...
That's what I started off with.
It is at least a refuge of right. sorts.
Calvinism, I think, deals with this successfully, though in a way that makes God look like a monster.
Yeah,
Universalism deals with this successfully, but in a way that makes the enterprise of Christianity irrelevant,
like waste of time.
Oh yeah, it's pretty pointless.
But those are really the only two. Those are the only two theological constructs I've encountered that actually take this problem seriously.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there also has something to do, I mean, if with Israel being his chosen people and then Jesus coming out of the tribe of Judah and then that link with all of those different things and Jesus being punished and these people witnessing this and seeing the consequences of their sin and their, you know, their blindness and refusal. And I mean, there was a message there clearly spoken to Israel. You know, there was a divine directive, you know, and how God was dealing with his people. And then we see this branching out, to the Gentiles as, a flowing out, from that particular event, which obviously, I mean, you know, Jesus could have just been like, well, you know, Israel's going to be obstinate and hard anyway. Why go there? You know, I'm just going to go ahead. I'm going to pop up in Russia and we'll see how Russia goes. You know, I mean, he could have just started there, but he started amongst his own people. And it's kind of, you know, he was showing them something. He was doing something in their particular history and in dealing with them and demonstrating the punishment that was due. And so I'm sure there's something along those lines, too, that I'll have to look at.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay.
Okay, last question, and this is kind of a doozy, I guess. Okay, last question here. You seem to trust what the Gospels say is what actually happened. I want to understand why. I have an analogy that I think might help. Suppose I hauled you into court on a murder charge, and the only evidence I had against you was a bunch of letters that described you murdering the victim in vivid detail. Of course, you would ask who wrote those letters. I answer, Joe, Mike, Bob, and Dan. You then ask, who are they? And I answer, well, I don't know for sure. Well, that's a dead end. So you would ask, well, how do they know any of the things that they claim in those letters? And I answer, I don't know. They never exactly say where they're getting their information. Well, okay, imagine that happened to you. Would you conclude that I had a convincing case against you? Do you believe the jury should conclude that you committed the murder those letters describe you committing?
No. No, I would not conclude that you had a convincing case. And you believe the jury should conclude? No, I would not believe the jury would conclude that. I think this is actually something that I was studying before school started. Wow, did you detect that tone before school started?
I'm actually really grateful that I'm there. I just sidetracked me from my other readings. Freaking school, learning about Jesus. Gosh.
I did not intend for that to sound like that. My professors are listening. But this book that I have that I picked up by, is it Richard or William? I always get Richard Bauckham, called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. This is one of those things that he addresses, actually. And I only made it a few chapters. Page 103. It's like 500 pages. And, only made it that far, but one of the things that he points out is a lot of the internal evidence within the gospel accounts themselves has been ignored because it's this, well, who are Joe, Mike, Bob, and Dan? It's, well, heck if I know. I don't know who those cats are. But that's precisely one of the things that he says has been ignored. And he says, well, you know, when you look at the names within the gospel accounts and how they were used, who they were talking to, and even the discrepancies amongst the accounts, he's saying, well, writing to particular traditions, writing to particular groups of people.
Audiences, yeah.
Audiences and traditions. I don't know why I said that. But yeah, writing to particular audiences, he's going to be able to say, you know, Joseph, the son of so-and-so. And when we look at that, we're like, okay. But to, you know, the people they're writing to, that would have made sense. We're like, oh yeah, I know that guy. But then, you know, and then we've got Matthew saying, oh, this woman who's the wife of so-and-so, who's the son of such-and-such. And that group of people would have understood. And so I was really starting to get into this, and then school started. But that's one of the things that addresses in here, is that it's not quite that simple where we can just be like, well, we don't really know who these people are. And, you know, how do they know that? Well, we don't know. There's actually stuff built into the gospel accounts that provides more evidence. And so I think that as far as that little analogy goes, I think there might be more to it, and I've got to look into that more.
I'd love to, when you get into that, I'd love to carry on that conversation with you over email, because that's something that has always interested me, was gospel authorship, and I've stumbled across some fun stuff on my end of things, too.
Oh, very cool. He says, so I guess the main part is he wants to understand why I would trust that what the gospels say is what actually happened. So now we're pulling away from stuff like questions 2 and 3 and getting into the historicity of it all. Having looked into some apologetic stuff for a long time and you know, reading Metzger's book on the transmission, corruption, and that's the third word of the New Testament texts, and you know, seeing them compared to other ancient texts that we have.
It's transmission, corruption, and restoration.
Restoration, thank you. And seeing all those things side by side, that, you know, that impressed me. It's like, wow, that's a lot. And, you know, that's a lot of manuscript evidence there, at least demonstrating, you know, this thing's pretty widespread. As far as it goes, obviously, we were talking about that earlier. And the number of the manuscripts and how there are difficulties within them. We do see redactions, we do see errors, etc. But overall, they're pretty coherent. And so, you know, taking a look at that, it's like, well, that's pretty impressive. You know, it doesn't totally... You know, that wouldn't be something that would totally sell me on the deal. And I want to make a distinction that that's not, all of these things aren't why I believe. And we could go back into that, but I'll spare you all that for now. I think, what's really interested me in reading the scriptures themselves is a lot of it is so, there's a lot of honesty involved, I guess. And I know, most of my answers here are going to be answers we've all heard a bajillion times, but I'm just speaking from my own experience. But in looking at how dumb Peter and some of the other apostles are, you know, that kind of thing surprises me. And you know, I'm like, well, why would there be this honesty in here? Why would they convey this way? You know, I know personally, if I'm trying to, you know, spread this, it would be that, well, Jesus was such a way, had such a personality, and ordained things in such a fashion that they all just got it. And they're now these ubermensches, you know, running around, and, you know, they get it, and they're empowered, and they never falter, and they're brilliant. You know, that's the kind of story I would construct. And so to see that, it's very human in a lot of ways, and having those things built in.
I know that you're asking kind of a rhetorical question, but I do have an answer for you.
Oh, well, no, I figured so.
Okay.
I figured you
would. Well, with regards to the disciples being, really dumb and really thick, there's two things going on there, I think. One is a literary device that's common to all scriptures, not just Jewish and Christian scriptures, but all scriptures. You have the all-wise guru and his really stupid followers. And his really stupid followers are stage dressing so that he has the opportunity to repeat and to nuance and to go at it from other angles. And they stand in for the new believer who doesn't know what these people would know, having traveled with this man for years.
And also potentially to make him look better.
And to make him look better in comparison to them. Then with Christianity, you also have the thing where, with the exception possibly of Matthew, all of the Gospels are coming through a Roman church and a Gentile tradition, and a Gentile tradition that was very, very, very hostile to its Jewish forebears, because not because the Jews killed Christ, that came in a little later, but because the Jews rejected Christ and Jerusalem was razed to the ground. They saw that as the judgment of God against Jerusalem for rejecting Christ. So the Jewish characters, all the Jewish apostles, look really stupid because the Jews as a people rejected Jesus, and it was the Gentile Jew that accepted Jesus through whom the gospel went to all of these churches. That, you know, that is why Jesus had to go outside to find another guy, because the Jews were too dumb.
Well, but like I said, some of them, I was careful, I didn't say all of them. Some of them are very stupid. Some of them aren't. And there are times where, you know, every once in a blue moon, Peter gets it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and well,
this is going to sound really cynical, but Peter has to get it every once in a while, because it is through him that the papal apostolic succession is traced.
Well, but even we, I mean, even if there is, you know, some kind of Socratic irony built into, you know, the, how the story's told, I don't think it detracts from, you know, any historicity or anything. And so I think, you know, if I'm going to weigh it one way or the other, you know, it makes perfect sense for me that, or it makes perfect sense to me that, you know, well, it was written this way and, you know, that's pretty much how a human responds. And so I see that, you know, other traditions do this. But it's pretty, I don't know, sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't, sometimes outside people get it, sometimes they don't. And so I think, I guess it's diverse enough that, you know, it's believable in that regard. I don't have to read that and be like, well, you know, other things were also like this, you know, so it's probably just a device. But I do see your point, so I don't want to just, I don't want to, you know.
Well, getting back to the metaphor that the question raises, are you essentially saying that if you had these four letters accusing you of murder, even though they're essentially anonymous, if they contained convincing characterizations of you, if they seemed like they really knew what they were talking about, would they be enough to convict you?
No. I don't, and I haven't totally said everything that I wanted to say about why, you know, I think.
All right, I'll shut up and let you talk.
No, totally sidetracked you. No, I like being challenged. I like it refines me. I get to think a little more and I don't get away with as much stuff that way. So, but as far as the analogy goes, I mean, I think that could be played on, you know, if this were being presented in a court, it's a really weird analogy, but if this were, you know, being presented in a court of law and, you know, these four letters got these things, they did get all my actions and characters that, you know, and he did it this way, you know, we could at least say, well, they at least, you know, whoever wrote these knows John or is really familiar with John somehow. So these are people close to him or they have, you know, I mean, that would be, you know, if that were the case, that would be pretty surprising, and that would be something at least to pay attention to.
Hmm. But it would still, there would still be room for reasonable doubt.
Oh, well, sure, yeah, yeah,
okay.
The court of law analogy is fun because that's what Lee Strobel uses in his apologetic books, which are really popular right now.
Yeah, that's true. He just came out with a new one, actually, on this very subject.
Oh, yeah,
The case for the real Jesus, is that what it is, or the real Christ?
Yeah, I think
something
so.
Like that.
Yeah, I flipped through it.
That poor guy. Poor people importance. Who read. Oh, I'm sorry.
It does help, though. I will say this much. I used to be a big fan of those, and they're good introductory books. And I think it gives people something to work with. But as far as, you know, I immediately, just because in my interactions with this stuff, the guy that has really impacted me the most has been Bob Price. I've listened to him so much and I've read so much of his stuff, you know, online and his blogs and interviews. And Zach, you know, I have read some of the books you gave me, and we will give your books back to you at the Grill. I promise you that. I have not, but,
I gotta interrupt you because I read, I'm sorry. I'm being an asshole. I know, but, we were talking earlier about the value of worship and spirituality, and if Zach has lent you The Reason-Driven Life,
you know, Bob's, I haven't.
Oh,
I haven't.
Chapter 13 in that really pertains to a lot of the stuff we've been talking today. In a non, you know, it's one of those thought-provoking books, not a I'm trying to argue to my point books. But I think you might find it really valuable, John.
Oh, it is so on my list, man. You can. Believe you me, I really want to get that one.
I'm actually, just as a side point, since you brought it up, I'm teaching a series from that book for the Church of Freethought.
No kidding.
I just started the first series today.
I'll be dang, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, my big appeal to that for that one and also the Paperback Apocalypse, my big appeal to both of those, to the reason-driven life and the paperback apocalypse, is because, as I think, I really want to be careful. I think the purpose-driven life has assisted some in certain areas. I'm intentionally being vague. And so I don't want to completely slam it, because I think even out of really, I think even out of books that I think are almost useless, sometimes you can find little nuggets. Sometimes there are little nuggets hidden. So I don't want to complete, you know, and I've seen some of Rick Warren's other stuff and Bible study books and stuff like that. And, you know, okay. Now as far as Paperback Apocalypse goes, I really want to get that one, because I started reading the Left Behind series a long time ago when they first came out, and my mom was just nuts about them. And so she was like, oh, you got to read these. And I'll be danged. I mean, they're fascinating to read, but I got to like book three. Don't even ask me what it's called, because I don't even want to remember, but I got in the middle of that book and I was like, what is going on? I don't see any of this anywhere, you know? And so I abandoned the whole project, because I was like, screw this. This is just going to distract me, and it's going to distract other people. And sure enough, man, oh my gosh, you'd go to church and people would be like, have you read those books? They're amazing. Do you really think that the Apache helicopter is going to rescue us from Wormwood coming down to destroy the dinosaurs? You know, and just it's like,
oh my,
this
gosh.
Is nuts, people. Let's get off this.
John, check out next week's Reprobates Hour, because I'm interviewing Price. I've got an interview with Price on the Paperback Apocalypse.
Dan, I love you.
You'll love it. It's great. We go into the history of the end of the world. It's great.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm really looking forward to that. But I'd picked up that Lee Strobel book at a Borders a while back, actually. And so I went back to the index, and all of these books, I immediately go back to the index. And I'm like, I want to see if they've wrestled with Bob Price. Because reading this stuff, I mean, he just really makes a good case on so much of his stuff. And when I emailed Daryl Bach, actually, I was like, man, on some of this stuff, I know he's wrong. I just don't know why, you know, and it's one of those deals like there's something going on here, but I'm not smart enough to figure it out. And so I immediately went back to the index and saw that in this book, Strobel mentioned Bob Price. And I was like, oh, yes, good. You know,
wow.
And so I flipped the page and there's just this very blip of a reference to Bob Price. And I was like, oh, come on.
I think he interviews Edwin Yamauchi in the book. There's a chapter with an interview with him, and I'm kind of curious to see how that goes, because he's fairly knowledgeable, I think. So I'd like to see what he says.
So yeah, I think they're useful, you know, as far as they can get somebody and just introducing stuff. But you know, at least you know, certainly on the level y'all are at, and you know, Richard Carrier and stuff, I think a lot of times they don't go very far. And someone who's going to want to try to put that on as the full armor of God and run out and, you know, yell at somebody like Bob Price at a coffee shop, they're just going to get trashed.
Well, the reason I hate them is, this is going to sound kind of silly because this is what they're intended to do, but the reason I hate them is because they give the answers. And it doesn't matter to me so much whether the answers are correct or not. I generally think they're not. But Strobel is one of the Josh McDowell crowd. He's not directly descended from McDowell, but there's a certain area of pop apologetics that has as its goal the putting to rest of doubts without teaching people to think. And when someone is engaged in that enterprise, even when they're on my side, in fact, more so when they're on my side, I really resent it because I think it's dishonest.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point.
So,
I sidetracked this. I'm sorry.
Have we put this to bed yet? I can't remember exactly where we left.
Well, we kind of went through question four. Did you guys answer question five before I got here?
Actually, that's the one we started with.
Okay.
So
did you hit question one?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you have something to say about it?
No, I think it's a really good question, though.
Okay. I agree.
I Zach, I was curious what you thought about that new little argument that I just thought of and wanted to try out as for the mythicist, for the, what is it? Like the archetype stuff.
This was in what you sent me?
The argument from similarity. Yeah, I had a new argument.
For question
four. Oh, lay it on me. I'd love to hear this.
No, not you, Dan. You're going to.
Oh. <Just kidding. laughs> Damn it. I always miss out on the cool time.
No. I thought something earlier where Lewis talks about, you know, the arguments from similarity where he says, you know, God saw the desires for us to see these things played out. And so that's why he did them this way. I like that answer in one regard, but in another regard, I don't like that answer. It seems too convenient in a way. We're just kind of like, wow, that's awfully nice of God to make it that. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, well, I see. They want someone who can do this. Well, there you go. And I don't know. I can't really put my finger on it necessarily, but for some reason, I don't like it totally. But
it's about the same reason I didn't like it.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's neat. I have kind of a response in that I think some of the miracles were, you know, you could easily point to, well, that's kind of what he was working with. You know, that's kind of what he was dealing with. And it's something, that even today that we're, you know, we see blind people and paralytics and, you know, leprosy patients and things like that. And so in his day, naturally, if he's going to do healings and that sort of thing, that's what he's working with. And so, you know, he heals the blind guy and there are plenty more to go around and all that kind of thing. But one thing that I thought of, and this is, it's in the same vein as Lewis, and it might be subject to the same criticism, and I'm well aware of that, and that's okay. Was part of God's purpose in a lot of what he does is knocking down idols and getting rid of, the views that people have of certain things. And so, you know, God points out in the prophets multiple times, why do you go to this temple? Why do you do this and worship this thing? Why do you depend on these gods that do nothing for you? Why do you pray this? Or why do you, you know, and that sort of thing. Why do you do this? They're just idols. And indeed in the Ten Commandments, and I know there are different versions, but, that's one of the first things he addresses is nothing else before me. Don't depend on anything else. Don't put anything before me because I am the one true God. And so what I thought might be interesting with that is, wow, totally lost it. Okay. We're coming back. Those stories about, you know, not Pythagoras, but, what we got here, Osiris, Dionysius. Okay. You know, Adonis and all these things. If people heard different accounts, of these people, you know, these legends where these guys heal people and bring, you know, raise people from the dead, or they themselves are raised from the dead and that sort of thing, then it would be pretty easy, for people to kind of follow along with that. Or, you know, in the case of like the Greek gods, you hear these legends of Zeus doing this and, well, we're afraid of Zeus, so let's put a statue up and let's make sure we do this, or, you know, let's burn incense to Caesar, let's do this. And we see throughout the Old Testament, you know, God's in the business of destroying idols, or, you know, at least, you know, communicating to his people that they shouldn't go that way. So if we're saying that within that context, these people had access to these stories and were able to borrow from these archetypes, I think it makes sense that, well, if those stories were in that context and there were people that believed these stories, then it's not altogether unrealistic that God would want to knock down those idols as well. And so instead of, oh, didn't you hear the story of the legend of so-and-so who healed this blind man? You know, that's really neat. instead of having that as what those people believed in, or those were the stories, it was, no, here's the real God really healing blind people, really raising from the dead. This is what you should depend on.
Jacques Ellul formulated that argument very well in The Subversion of Christianity, in which he argued that he eventually believed that Christianity was true because it took the old forms and subverted them gave them a different spin and a different meaning.
That's an, and, you know, it's an interesting, it's kind of like Lewis's approach, and it's a neat little, inversion of Justin Martyr's, you know, demonic,
yeah, it really is an inversion of that,
It's an inversion of that, and it's sort of a combination of, or it's beholden to Lewis's approach to a certain extent, but not quite. What it really is, it's more of like a providential preparing of the soil, mm-hmm. right? That's what you're really getting at.
Yeah, and I guess Kant addressed that to a certain extent too. And he, I think it was Kant. No, it was Barth. Barth got into at one point during his books, and I can't for the life of me remember which book or essay it was, but he got into talking about the problem of idols and how humanity tends to make an idol of any picture it gets of God or of any God. Mm-hmm. And he argued that the gospel was supposed to be so upsetting and disturbing that it removed our desire or ability to espouse a particular concept of God, where we had to step back and say that God is who he is. We don't know even if he is a he, even if he exists, even if he is a conscious being as we would understand him. We believe that he is and allow him to be whatever that is. Mm. That's very, the Neo-Orthodox school picked that up, and they were very big on that.
That actually kind of makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that even as an atheist, I think that sounds like the most reasonable way to explain the parallelism that you see. I think that's probably the most, I guess, we were talking about the emotional impact before of the, of these parallel myths and legends and things like that. I think that's the most emotionally, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the most emotionally satisfying way to deal with the existence of these parallel gods and myths and things like that.
It always seemed that way to me. I was kind of a follower of the Neo-Orthodox school for the last couple of years I was a Christian, and I found it probably the most emotionally satisfying of all my, various theological experiences.
Hmm.
Yeah, and one thing that has really struck me in thinking about some of this is that if this information, where the parallelism, if these stories and legends were ubiquitous to the point of these writers borrowing from them, I'm guessing there is an answer, but I'm honestly asking the question, why would they have addressed these same people in the same group within which these accounts were existent? Because it seems to me, these things have been written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. I mean, if they're writing this stuff to these people who were equally as likely of recognizing these parallels, it seems, I mean, that's really kind of dumb. I mean, why would people?
We can say that as modernists, because as modernists, we are accustomed to the idea that there is such a thing as truth with a capital T. Even if we can never know it all the way, we believe that this is the case. And science has trained us to think that way, because there really is only one way to make water. You combine hydrogen and oxygen in a certain proportion, and that is the truth with a capital T. There's no way to get around that. The ancient world, the religious marketplace is a little bit more like a bazaar. It's a Chinese menu type bazaar. You can take one from column A, one from column B, and kind of right. Like New Age is
mix and match.
in that kind of a context, if you're wanting to prove my God is bigger than your God and my God is more powerful and is the one that's worth following and risking the wrath of these other gods for, you want a God that does the same stuff but does it better.
But wouldn't it, these people, especially the authors and some of their audiences, I guess John's was probably a Gentile audience, but wouldn't... I see, and I guess obviously I might be applying a framework that I'm comfortable with, and it's one that I've been raised in onto, the Jewish way of looking at things. But even whether commonsensically or with looking at it in a more detailed way, don't we see the correspondence view of truth at play? Within, like the Old Testament where God says, okay, you want to know if somebody's really a prophet? Whatever they say, if that comes true, then you know that they're a prophet. So it seems that he's saying, look, if someone says this about reality, and then right. that statement corresponds with reality, then you see that's true. And so it would make sense, these people writing to their own Jewish audience, if they're trying to point to something that, indeed, they are giving a capital T truth to, then do you see what I'm saying? I guess
I see what you're saying. I think I didn't nuance what I was saying well enough. When the ancient world was generally on the level of the hoi polloi, of the common people, was henotheistic at best. It wasn't, not even any time throughout the Old Testament, and only in glimpses in the New, do you see any kind of notion that there really is only one God. You only see the notion that there is one true God, and there are other gods that are real beings, but are somehow not as cool, not as supreme as our God.
Yeah.
Paul chalks them up to be demons. Moses seems... in his discourses in Exodus, seems to believe that they are gods and that the Jewish tribal God is just the one that they owe allegiance to because he brought them out of Egypt. And there's a development throughout the Old Testament, particularly if you read it in the order it is in the Jewish Bible, of this concept of God from a primitive tribal deity to the God of the philosophers that comes into Christianity sometime after the end of the New Testament. So on the level of the hoi polloi, this is going to sound really denigrating, and I don't mean it to, but it's a McDonald's or Burger King type of choice, right? Who has the better? They both have hamburgers, but whose is better, right? Mm. Now, on the level of the philosophers, you have a different situation because you have, even in the 3rd century BC, you have Epicurus, and then in the 2nd century AD, you have Lucretius echoing him when he says, religion is throughout the world viewed by the common people as true, by the philosophers as false, and by the politicians as useful. And the question of whether or not there was a God, a singular God, is one that is taken up by Socrates for the first time in written memory. I'm sure it was around before then, but the first time we have written records of that being a legitimate question is with Socrates. And not even Zoroastrianism, which is almost monotheistic, is quite that radical. Socrates introduces the idea of one God who is the force behind the faces that people worship. And that idea comes down through Platonism and gets merged in with Christianity in the late 1st, early 2nd century.
Right.
And that's what gives us this notion that there can be only one, like the Highlander.
And I think that's what really makes things so complicated when we look back at the Gospels and we look back at the letters of Paul. We have no choice but to, as modern people looking back, we have to look through that filter of the combination of Christianity with the God of the philosophers. And that's a union that was very productive for Christianity, but it makes it very difficult to look back at, the founders of, and the original scriptures and to ascertain what they actually mean, because we cannot help but conceive of the god of the philosophers anytime the ancients talked about the deity.
Well, I'll let you know how that goes when I finish my Merrill Westfall book on overcoming ontotheology.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Oh, it is a lot of fun.
We'll have to do a show on that, and you could take the lead. That would rock.
Oh yeah, man,
definitely.
I looked at a paper I wrote on Derrida a while back, and I have no idea what on earth I was saying. I looked at this, and this was a few years ago, and I looked at him like, what did I write? I got an A on this paper, but I don't even know what I wrote. And so I have to try to get back into that mindset and looking at this stuff and get back into it, because I think there's something incredibly useful there, and it will actually serve a purpose in dealing with some of this stuff in how, you know, we do see Greek philosophy influencing Christianity, but I don't think that throughout its history that it's always been that way. And I think there's still something we can point to, recognizable even today as close to the Christianity then. But we have to do some digging and some shedding of a lot of
I would love to do
clothing.
That show.
Yeah.
I would love to do that show. Well, that's a topic that interests me greatly.
Oh, fantastic.
Let's make a note of it. All right, gentlemen. Well, I think we've done more or less due diligence to the Jesus myth hypothesis. We've definitely had a productive discussion today. I think we've put a lot of this stuff to bed, or at least settled it down a little bit, and may have cast up some interesting topics for further podcasts. So I'd like to thank you again for your participation, and we will see you next time on Apologia.
Pop in this A-track. You just give a listen to what you think.